Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy. David Hume, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 3.
Hume's economic philosophy says that human beings are driven by their passions, yet they can create a viable community based on pursuing wealth. Hume goes so far as to say that pursuing wealth has a beneficial social influence. This leads to an important question. Is self-interest compatible with a public interest? Can an ethical theory reconcile self-fulfillment with our obligations to others? Hume thinks the answer is yes. To understand Hume's answer, we must understand the revolution in moral thinking during the 17th and 18th centuries. Modern thinkers in general, that is, thinkers since the Renaissance, have turned inward in search of standards. They've become more and more aware that an observer influences what he sees, or at least determines how to interpret it. We see this new thinking in such diverse areas as the discovery of three-dimensional perspective in Renaissance painting, and in Copernicus's claim that the Earth moves around the sun. Modern thinking has also given us a new view of nature. The classical and medieval world saw nature as suffused with purpose. But the world of modern science has led thinkers to believe that nature is a vast mechanism, devoid of internal purpose. Modern thinkers believe that mankind must now look inward to discover purpose and moral order. So it's no accident that during the Protestant Reformation, thinkers turned inward in seeking the voice of God. This new moral thinking raises four important questions. First, is there an inwardly discoverable moral domain? Second, if there is such a domain, how do we find it? Third, how does this discovery motivate us? And finally, how are moral motives related to non-moral motives? Some philosophers before Hume, such as Thomas Hobbes and Bernard Mandeville, had denied that an inwardly discoverable moral domain exists. Both Hobbes and Mandeville had denied this inner morality in asserting that men ultimately pursue their self-interest. Mandeville also argued that pursuing individual wealth inadvertently but necessarily leads to public prosperity. The very title of Mandeville's most famous work carries this message, namely The Fable of the Bees, or Private Vices, Public Benefits. In this work, published in 1714, Mandeville says that the wise legislator will not waste his time preaching to men that they ought to be good. Instead, he'll try to make the pursuit of private interest consistent with the public interest. Although Hume agrees with Mandeville that pursuing private luxury had public benefits, he thinks Mandeville went too far in denying the existence of morality altogether.
Those who have denied the reality of moral distinctions may be ranked among the disingenuous disputants. Nor is it conceivable that any human creature could ever seriously believe that all characters were alike entitled to the affection and regard of everyone. Let a man's insensibility be ever so great, he must often be touched with the images of right and wrong.
Hume says there is an inescapable moral dimension to human life. The real issue, then, is how to understand it. Among philosophers who took the moral dimension seriously, a second quarrel ensued. When some action or character trait is recognized as good or bad, is that a special act of reason or a special kind of feeling? This is what's meant by the question, what is the source of moral apprehension? Hume sides with those who claim that there is a moral sense, that the act of moral apprehension is a special kind of feeling rather than an act of the intellect. Hume uses the example of crime to deny that we discover morality by reason or intellect.
Reason judges either of matter of fact or of relations. Inquire then first, where is that matter of fact which we here call crime? Point it out. Determine the time of its existence. Describe its essence or nature. Explain the sense or faculty to which it discovers itself. It resides in the mind of the person who is ungrateful. He must therefore feel it and be conscious of it. But nothing is there except the passion of ill will or absolute indifference. You cannot say that these of themselves, always and in all circumstances, are crimes. No, They are only crimes when directed towards persons who have before expressed and displayed goodwill towards us. Consequently, we may infer that the crime of ingratitude is not any particular individual fact, but arises from a complication of circumstances which, being presented to the spectator, excites the sentiment of blame by the particular structure and fabric of his mind.
Hume doesn't deny that feelings are influenced by intellectual judgments, but he does deny that reason can totally control our feelings. We already have certain prior feelings, so our judgment can direct only our subsequent feelings.
Reason is, and ought only to be, the slave of the passions.
Moral perception depends on our attitude and our sensibilities. Let's take, for example, the apprehension of color. To say that something is red is to say that it emits light waves of a certain length, which, if detected by the normal human nervous system under normal lighting conditions, create a certain sensation. If we're not dealing with human beings, or if these human beings are colorblind, or if the lighting conditions aren't taken into account, either a different color or no color will be perceived. Similarly, moral perception cannot exist apart from human sensibilities and judgment. The Renaissance discovery of perspective in art makes us aware that much of what we see is conditioned by the circumstances or attitude of the perceiver. Modern moral philosophy has turned inward in search of standards because modern thinkers are aware of how much our prior attitude changes what we see and how we interpret our experience.
Take any action allowed to be vicious. Willful murder, for instance. Examine it in all lights, and see if you can find that matter of fact which you call vice. The vice entirely escapes you as long as you consider the object. You never can find it till you turn your reflection into your own breast and find a sentiment of disapprobation which arises in you towards this action. Here is a matter of fact, but it is the object of feeling, not of reason. It lies in yourself, not in the object. So that when you pronounce any action or character to be vicious, you mean nothing but that from the constitution of your nature, you have a feeling or sentiment of blame from the contemplation of it. Vice and virtue, therefore, may be compared to sounds, colors, which, according to modern philosophy, are not qualities in objects, but perceptions in the mind.
A special problem confronts moral theorists like Hume, who say that sentiment is the source of moral apprehension. Is there a way to reach a general agreement, a consensus on our sentiments? Hume responds in two ways. First, he says that our moral response is always from the general social perspective, not a personal one.
It is only when a character is considered in general, without reference to our particular interest, that it causes such a feeling or sentiment as denominates it morally good or evil.
To use moral language is to invoke a social perspective. By its very nature, this social perspective distinguishes between a purely personal reaction and a reaction that would be shared by others in the same frame of reference.
The very nature of language guides us almost infallibly in forming a moral judgment. And as every tongue possesses one set of words which are taken in a good sense and another in the opposite, the least acquaintance with the idiom suffices, without any reasoning to direct us in collecting and arranging the estimable or blamable qualities of men.
Many theorists before Hume had argued that moral apprehension is based on reason, that morality is objective. If this is true, then moral apprehension refers to a state of affairs totally independent of our wills, our preferences, or our interests. But Hume denies that moral situations are totally objective, and he has several reasons. One is that if moral situations are totally independent of human perspective, then animals and inanimate objects will have to be morally evaluated just the way people are.
Choose any inanimate object, such as an oak or elm, and let us suppose that by the dropping of its seed, it produces a sapling below it, which, springing up by degrees, at last overtops and destroys the parent tree. I ask if, in this instance, there be wanting any relation which is discoverable in patricide or ingratitude. Is not one tree the cause of the other's existence, and the latter the cause of the destruction of the former, in the same manner as when a child murders his parent? The relations are the same. And as their discovery is not in both cases attended with a notion of immorality, it follows that that notion does not arise from such a discovery.
Hume tells us the human response is an integral part of what makes a situation moral or immoral. There is no purely objective dimension to moral apprehension. If the only choices in conceiving morality are between pure objectivity and pure subjectivity, then Hume's account of moral apprehension would have to be classified as subjective. But these are not the only choices. There's another sense of objectivity that philosophers call intersubjective. To say that something is intersubjective is to say that all those who share the same perspective will have the same emotional response. As Hume reminds us, this is the way in which we judge color, or beauty, or distance. Hume describes the analogy with the sense of beauty.
It is evident a beautiful countenance cannot give so much pleasure when seen at a distance of 20 paces as when it is brought nearer us. We say not, however, that it appears to us less beautiful, because we know what effect it will have in such a position, and by that reflection we correct its momentary appearance.
Second, Hume describes the analogy with distance perception.
All objects seem to diminish by their distance, but though the appearance of objects to our senses be the original standard by which we judge of them, yet we do not say that they actually diminish by the distance, but correcting the appearance by reflection, arrive at a more constant and established judgment concerning them.
But Hume faces a second problem in asserting that sentiment is the source of moral apprehension. If moral judgments reflect a standard perspective arrived at by consensus, how can individuals adopt that perspective, especially when no one else is around to reach a consensus? Here, Hume invokes a second important moral doctrine, sympathy. Used here in a rather technical sense, sympathy means the ability to put ourselves into someone else's position, to imagine what that other person feels, and then actually to feel something identical or similar to that feeling. Hume's concept of sympathy is more like what we would call empathy.
We may begin with considering anew the nature and force of sympathy. The minds of men are similar in their feelings and operations, nor can any one be actuated by any affection of which all others are not, in some degree, susceptible. As in strings wound up, the motion of one communicates itself to the rest, so all affections readily pass from one person to another, and beget correspondent movements in every human creature. When I see the effects of passion and the voice and gesture of any person, my mind immediately passes from these effects to their causes, and forms such a lively idea of the passion as is presently converted into the passion itself.
This is the end of part 3. Please download part 4 to continue.